Hi, my name's Charlie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank Larry for asking me to come here and talk tonight. It's always an honor to be a participant in an AA meeting, as opposed to my behavior in the past, which was not participatory at all. It's always good to be here. I came to this meeting when I was about 3 weeks sober. It was a big night for me. I was living in Anaheim at the time, which is certainly the cultural hub of Western civilization. And got here, and everybody was really excited because Chuck C was going to speak that night. And I had no clue who Chuck C was, except that I'd heard about him the week before at the meeting I was going to in Tustin, and he seemed to be some regional celebrity. And I thought, well, maybe I should go someplace where I haven't already seen the feature attraction, and realized I had no place to go, really. This was my whopping one AA meeting a week, and I better stay and check it out. And I'm glad I came here, and this is an honor to be asked to speak at this meeting. I'm an alcoholic. That's my drug of choice. That's the only drug that did it for me. I've done my share of drugs, but I never bought, so I wasn't an addict. And I can say with some safety that I've never used Pam either. I don't like my high to have a buttery aftertaste, you know? I was thinking if you got busted for having it, the charges wouldn't stick. I couldn't resist. I'm sorry. You can be sure that won't happen again. Like I said, I'm a drunk by trade, and I never intended to be. I had a moral objection to alcohol ever since I was a little kid. I had a moral objection to any kind of bad behavior. I was raised Catholic, and I took it seriously. I didn't know that other Catholics maybe didn't take it as seriously as I did, but I thought that when they said no, it meant no. No. N-O. No. And I tried to keep my behavior as upright as possible, but I was hedging on the side. And I didn't like it when my parents drank, and they drank like once a year, and they weren't alcoholic, but I thought it was a sign of moral weakness that they were taking out that holiday bottle, you know, and serving it to these so-called friends. And I was a cynic by the time I was 8 years old, so I knew that they weren't really their friends. And I was embarrassed by my background. My father and mother were just working class people. My dad was a carpenter, and you know, as I tell it, my mother was a humble virgin woman. And I was, all the other kids' dads seemed to have jobs where they wore ties to work, and they drove nice cars, and my dad was always in those gray dungarees that carpenters wear, and he always had, you know, those thick squishy soles shoes, and he was always helping people and doing that kind of stuff. And I was just embarrassed about him because I loved him, but I didn't understand how to show that, and I really wished I had better, you know. Nothing was ever quite enough for me, although I felt guilty about that because I was sure it was supposed to be enough, and I never felt satisfied with anything in my life. And I didn't even start drinking till I was 18. I was a late bloomer certainly by my group's standards. You know, we've got embryonic drunks in that group, and I didn't start till I was well out of high school. But when I started, I made up for lost time. I enjoyed it. I have a tendency to think, which if you're new, really, don't do that, because that will get you in trouble. I was one of those people. I was sick a lot when I was a kid, so I'd sit at home and I'd read and I'd watch TV, and I got every notion I ever had about life from watching television and from reading books, and I had this ideal sense of how human beings were supposed to behave. I had this very high ideal about humanity and what people were supposed to do with their lives and all that, and yet nobody could live up to my standards. Certainly not me, but at least I tried. The rest of you were just dragging your feet. And the older I got, you know, I got to be 14 and wound up painting my room black and putting in this dark green shag carpet in the room and sitting in there listening to my Doors albums and getting kind of spooky, and I hadn't touched anything. I just couldn't stand being around people or being around me alone. So it puts you in a rather delicate position at that point. And I came out of my room when I was about 18 and was working in this record store, and a bunch of the hoodlums from my neighborhood came in. And I've always secretly admired criminals. Not like I could ever do it, you know, because I couldn't even kick my own ass, you know, much less anybody else's. But I'm the type of person, I pull off a strong arm robbery and feel really bad and give it back, you know. Well, here's 20 for your wife. And but I liked watching other people get beaten and do all that stuff. I always found that rather exciting. And so I started going down where these people hung out, which was a Winchell's donut shop on the corner of Euclid and Ball in Anaheim. And I'd go down there after I got off work, and they'd all stand around and tell stories. And everybody was lying through their teeth, but I didn't know that. I thought they were telling the truth, and I got my own set of stories, and I was lying. They probably thought I was telling the truth, and we were all happy. We were just like a bunch of pigs in paradise there. And then one time they said, let's just go to a party. So there were these parties going on all over the place on the weekends. So we went to this party, and I got drunk. And I know I'd had drinks in my life before that, but I had never felt like I did that night after 6 malt liquors. My entire perspective of the world changed for some reason. I only realized in retrospect it's because I'm an alcoholic. I didn't realize it didn't work that way for 90% of the people at that party. But for me and for probably most of the guys I came there with, it was working. And I learned a lot of things that night about alcohol and didn't even realize. I learned, first of all, that all of those feelings of separation and disappointment and anger and resentment and hostility and rejection and all those negative things, those negative emotions that I'm so comfortable with went away. I felt unified. I felt at ease. Everybody looked fine. I had possibilities on the horizon that I could not only see them, but I felt them. I knew them. I knew I could do something with my life, finally. And I knew I was going places, and I was going there in a hurry tomorrow. But for tonight, I'm just going to think about these possibilities. And what happened was, you know, it lasted 13 years of waiting till the next day to get anything done, because alcohol did for me what it does to a lot of people. You know, it gave me the satisfaction of having completed a job well done without ever having to do anything. I just felt good, felt completely satisfied, and to do anything would be redundant. You know what I mean? I thought about writing the great American novel. I got all the way to getting the paper and the typewriter. Got my name on there. Sometimes I'd get a title on the page. Then I'd have to go in and drink. And that I did. And I did. I have the wimpiest drunkalog in AA. I did the stuff that I hear a lot of people talk about their lives after drinking. I dream the life most people lived as far as comparisons go. I pretty much went to bars, sat at the elbow of the bar, watched everybody else drink. I drank at places like the Humdinger on Garden Grove, on Harbor Boulevard, and then there's one on Lincoln, and there's one on Trask, or there used to be. It's quite a chain. AA is the only place you can go and mention the Humdinger, and you can see half the people in the room go, "Well, I've been there." I drank. I only met one other person in all my. I've been in AA since for about 8 years and 10 months and 3 weeks. And I'm only one person who's been to the Crystal Pistol in Anaheim. They closed it. It got too nasty. They kept finding undercover cops in the dumpster behind the place. And I drank there, you know, and I don't fit in. You know, I didn't look much differently than I do now. I've gained a few pounds, but I'm on that buy bigger pants diet. You know, I just keep getting bigger pants and get a haircut. I look great. And just get big old necks on the shirt. People say, "If you've been losing weight, you look great." And I drank at the Crystal Pistol. I like the most dangerous places you can go, the places that seem like there might be a possibility that I'm not going to get out alive. And that's the kind of life I enjoyed, was just going there, but not, I was never in the action. I enjoy watching everybody else participate. Life is a viewer's sport, as far as I'm concerned. To get in is too much of a commitment. I'd rather observe and learn and gain wisdom from your failure than to actually embark on anything and have the chance of failing myself. And I just drank, you know. I went to the limits of what I could take. I wound up in hospitals. I wound up in the bloody urine club. I wound up with driving around with pillows in the back of my in my car seat to keep my kidneys from bouncing around during lane changes. I got married in that time and met a non-alcoholic woman, neurotic but non-alcoholic, and you know, together we made a complete person. It's just perfect. We sort of like scorpions locking tails in that fatal dance, you know, and she did everything she could to save me, and I did everything I could to simultaneously allow her to save me and destroy myself at the same time, and just frustrated the hell out of her. And she's still in therapy. I'm here. She's a wonderful woman. I don't mean to make it sound, I'm not trying to be flippant about this lady. She was a good wife. She did what she had to do and what she could do for me. And I had no idea of what to do in a marriage. I thought marriage was going to make me something different. It was going to fix me. It was going to lend me the sophistication I always knew I had, but just couldn't find. You know, I misplaced it someplace. And I never got it. Never got it there. I never got it trying to validate myself by chasing around or by sitting around with sad music on, drinking 10 high bourbon in my house and listening to really, really sad, you know, little Bob Seger to get you in the right mood and thinking about life in general and how tragic it was. And I'd, you know, stagger over to the typewriter and sit down and roll in some paper and then pass out and not write. But that was my job. I by that time, I was in the publishing industry. I was unloading trucks at a bookstore, and it was a starter job, you know, it was like entry-level position, but I was with books. I figured it was part of the experience, and I'm working on this receiving dock at this college, a college bookstore, and I was a functioning drunk. I'd get to work in the morning. I'd wait till about, I would get to work most mornings swearing I will not drink again. By this time, I made a big geographic from Anaheim to Santa Monica, and I swore I would never drink again because every morning. And I'd get there and I'd feel terrible and remorseful. And I'd sit there for about an hour because I was my own boss pretty much. And these little old ladies that worked at the store loved me. You know, they treated me like their abandoned son. And everybody was trying to work on me, you know, make me happy and set me up with their daughters and stuff like that. And one couple, really, I saw them today. I went to visit them and I hadn't talked to them for a long time. And they used to invite me over to their house. This lady and her husband would say, "Why don't you come over to our house? And we have Jack Daniels over at our house, too." And they just didn't understand, you know, that it's not a fat chance I'm going to get any excitement sitting around your house. First of all, it doesn't smell. And it's not likely that I'm going to be getting anybody in a headlock soon and start, you know, fighting my way out or watching anybody else beat their way out of your house. And that's what I enjoyed. And I enjoyed the possibility of finding her out there, because I've been on hormone alert since God knows when, and I'm this vibrating vessel of testosterone all the time. And I always wanted to be thought that way, you know. It's just, he's not much to look at, but he's a killer in the sack. Think about it. But that was, you know, fiction was my life. And I, while I was married, that wife helped put me through school. And I was working as a reporter for a newspaper in Orange County. And it was a big job. And my first day there, I thought I was going to be making coffee for the editors, and they put me on a story, and I got a story in every single time I was there. They'd send me out to do the job, and I'd go out and try to get the job done because I was under pressure. I had to do it, and I'd get it done, and I couldn't stand the pressure because I knew I was a nobody inside, and I knew it was just a matter of time before they found out that I was a nobody. They weren't paying me for this job either. I just realized that in sobriety that I was doing it for free, you know, and I still felt less than. Like they weren't getting their money's worth, you know? And I'd run out, and the minute that shift was over, I was down at a bar somewhere. I was looking for a bar. I didn't know the neighborhood in Costa Mesa, so I'd just drive down the street and find the tackiest looking place that had maybe a curtain over the open door, and that's my place, because I feel comfortable there. I feel comfortable in really what people would call dives. I'm completely at ease there looking at the light behind the bar of the Budweiser Clydesdales, you know that one, and Margaret's hot sandwiches, smile, no extra charge, with a little sign on it, and pickled eggs and Slim Jims and recycled Slim Jims in the next room. And I knew that was where I was going to die. I knew that I'd take about 18 shots of whiskey like Dylan Thomas did and turn around and say, that must be some kind of a record, and just drop over dead on the floor and have everyone sit there and say, wow, that was great. But I'd get about 6 shots in me, and I'd just pee my pants. And I knew that was no way to go. And I didn't have enough guts to be violent, but I hated everybody. There's nothing worse than feeling that way and having no intentions of carrying it out. Just feeling hostility and rage and just being it's like being an angry gerbil, you know? People just look at you and go, honey, look at the gerbil, it's pissed. And that makes me madder, but I can't show it, you know, because I don't want you to not like me. And so I've got that conflict going about, I hate you, I really detest you, but it would be nicer if you did like me. And that would make me hate you even more because you're a phony on top of everything else. But and that went on and on and on and on until I just got so crazy on alcohol and this conflict of going to work in the morning, and I was in the process of a divorce, and I knew that civilization was falling apart as quick as my life was, and I wound up going to the store and buying bags and bags and bags of canned food with money I didn't have. I would just go to the ready teller and get all my money out, you know, and go to the store and get bags of canned goods and toilet paper and stuff and store it up in my hall closets because I was renting my mother's house at that time. And I'm storing up all this food for the end of the world. You know, I thought civilization was going to collapse. There are going to be food riots. And all you people that invested in stocks are screwed, because food is where it's at. And I had well-meaning friends who would try to sit me down and say, "What? Are you all right?" Because I was bona fide at that point. But I knew at the time that it was not me. And it's like when people keep telling you it's you when you're sober, and you keep saying, there are some times when I know it is not me. It is all of them. I am fine. Thank you. And they keep saying, better start working your steps again. It's like, you don't get it, do you? It's not me. And that's how I felt at the time, except I had no program. I was just drinking. And I would sit there and, you know, count my food goods. And I'd go out on my lunch break and go down to the gun shop down the street from Santa Monica College. Here's Mr. Nice Guy on the job, you know, this sort of Wally Cox weirdo wandering around the back of this bookstore. And then I'd trot on down to the gun shop during my lunch break and look at the guns and start figuring out how much money am I going to need to get a pistol and a rifle, some ammunition. And I'm going to need that when the neighbors start running over. I'm going to blast them and I'm going to show them exactly what's wrong. Except I'm the type, I'm not going to kill them outright, you know. I'm going to shoot them and then I'm going to go up and tell them why I had to, you know. You didn't listen, did you? Okay, and I had to do this. But I had all these things going, you know, that I'd go out in public and just be, hold doors open for little old ladies and just be a nice guy. And I'm vibrating all over the place. And I helped get my sister-in-law put into a care unit. She had an alcohol problem, and I knew because I drank with her. And she got out of that care unit right about a week after I'd had my divorce papers served on me. And I was at the end. I'd been in therapy. I'd been to, you know, the meetings of Association of Humanist Psychiatrists. I've been to the Baptist church. I'd been everywhere just checking it out, and nothing fit because there was always a catch. There was always a catch in there somewhere, and I didn't want the catch. And I wanted to live my life, and I thought, I took drugs to try to see what that would do, and I didn't want drugs. I didn't want to be bored, for God's sake. I want to be in life. I want to grab it. I want to suck it up. I want to get the grapes of life and crush them against the roof of my mouth and feel the nectar and feel the wind blowing in what's left of my hair and charge out into life just with great exuberance, but I just couldn't get up, I just sit there and I think, well, tomorrow, I'll do it. And I couldn't do anything at all except go to work and go get drunk and then go home and drive drunk on that freeway. And if you're driving drunk, you know what that's like. It's whatever distance of time it takes to get home of terror, all right? And yet, we're pretty clever, because I never got a 502. I got pulled over plenty, but I never got picked up for it, because I'm smart. I know that when you start zigging into the other lane, it looks really bad when you whip back into your lane. They might as well shine a spotlight on you and say, now presenting drunk driver. So I'd start drifting into the other lane, just put on my blinker. Can finish the lane change. They don't bag you for that. And I was crazed at that point, and I went to visit this girl after she got out of the care unit, and she 12-stepped me. And I didn't even know I was being 12-stepped at the time. And she'd been going to AA meetings in that unit, and she had the program. She had it enough to convince me to just come to a meeting with her. And I didn't want to go, but she made it sound as if I were just doing her a favor by giving her a ride to the meeting. So I went, and it was a Sunday night Tustin meeting, and I went there, and I just was, it was late June of 1981. I was wearing a tweed jacket and sweater, sunglasses, deerstalker hat, looking good. And everybody came up with that, "Are you new?" And I was mad because I knew I had potential. I looked at this pack of losers in that room and thought, no way. This is the end of the line. This looks like the Greyhound bus station in here. I know I've got more potential than this. I've come too far down. Maybe I should go back up another level. Maybe go back to the Rosicrucians. And I was there with her, and she kept dragging me around by the hand. And I was so defiant, and yet I had this person saying, "Sit down, Charles." And I'd sit down. "Okay, you can stand up now. It's time for a coffee break." Oh, and she would guide me around this place, because I decided not to drink a week earlier, because I'd had an experience at a meditation retreat where I was going to commit suicide, but that doesn't count. I didn't do it because I was too wimpy to do it. I didn't have the guts to kill myself, and I didn't want to live either. And I was in that quandary that a lot of us find ourselves, where you just cannot bear to think of getting up again in the morning and going through that same sense of isolation, that same sense of loneliness, that same sense of knowing that you are right and the entire world is wrong, and that sense of knowing that you've got to put on that act again to go out there and deal with these fools and smile and hold it all in and go through life and go through the paces just so you can reward yourself at the end of the day by going out and drinking again and try to get that, dress up that misery with some daydreams again. But by that time, I couldn't even daydream anymore. I couldn't even get a good fantasy going. I couldn't even lie to myself one more time. It was just all over at this retreat, and I thought about hanging myself, and I got a moment of clarity that the Big Book talks about, and I realized that I was nowhere. I'd finished. I was at the end of everything. I had my nose pressed against the wall, and I couldn't go any further. And it just simultaneously made me come unglued and made me feel like there might be some way of changing at the same time. I can't explain it any other way than that. I felt like I had to give up, and that I felt so relieved at that moment to just say, "That's it. I can't do anything anymore." I sat there and cried at this thing. I'm not a big public crier. I don't like that kind of stuff, but sometimes it happens. But it ain't going to happen tonight. The thing was, I was ready. And I didn't go to a meeting for a week. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I just thought I'd just lost some of my social skills. And I was I went to the meeting with this girl, and I identified as an alcoholic, and Lord knows I didn't want to. And she told me I didn't have to after I did, which I appreciated. And if there had been anybody there who knew me, I would have been humiliated. And although no one had known me, because I hadn't gone out of the house in 4 years, so I mean, it's just, it wasn't like the social butterfly of Anaheim. And they had, you know, what we knew, what you experience when you're new here. You feel alienated. You feel different. You feel weird, like this whole thing is going on, and you really don't know what's happening, but you can't go anywhere else. And they're all talking. They're all responding to the person at the podium. Hi, my name's Ed. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Ed. And I thought that was just awful, you know, just horrible that they would respond like that. So smarmy. So much like the Catholics. The Lord be with you and also with you. And no feeling, and it just hi. And I think it'd be a lot better in AA meetings if someone said, hi, I'm Ed and I'm an alcoholic, and everybody said, we know. That would make sense to me, but for everybody who wants to say hi, it's overwhelming when you're new. It just terrifies you. It's like, uh-oh, here it is. This is it. Pretty soon they're going to start beating a drum, and they're all going to walk single file out of the meeting and start looting. And then they had a coffee break, and then 7,000 people came running up to me saying, are you new? Are you new? Nice to meet you. Glad you're here. Keep coming back. And all I could think was, just get your insipid happiness away from me. You may be happy as hell, and boy, that makes me glad for you, but just stay away from me. I don't want this. And at the same time, inside, feeling like, yes, I do want this. I don't want to feel this way about wanting this, you know? I was confused when I got here and didn't feel happy to be here at all because I thought it was a sign of failure to be at Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous was a joke that Johnny Carson made. It was a derogatory statement for somebody. It was a sign of you're a loser, go to AA. And I didn't want to be a loser, you know, but I was. I'd thwarted every opportunity I'd ever had in my life to make something out of myself besides being a receiving clerk at a bookstore. That little stepping stone job that I took, that I was there for 12 years. And so I went back to that meeting the next week to watch my sister-in-law get a chip. Oh, my heart was pounding that night. Oh, this, imagine a chip. And she got her 30-day chip, and all of her friends from the care unit were there. They're like linked together with those arm bracelets that they wear. And everybody wept and hugged and kissed and all that stuff, you know. And 2 days later, she was drunk. And she's never been back to Alcoholics Anonymous since, you know. And I'm eternally grateful to that woman for bringing me to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I don't know why I'm here, really, and why she's not. There's no reason why, except that when I listened, I was ready enough to listen to things that people told me that I didn't even understand or believe in, and just did them, because I didn't have any other suggestions. You know, I'd sort of run out my suggestion box. And I went to meetings there for another week, and I got there real early. I got there at 4:30. It was a 7:30 meeting. And I had a bottle of Jack Daniels at home, and it had been sitting there for 3 weeks, and I didn't want to drink it. And it was a nice Sunday afternoon, and I came there thinking that there might be some alcoholics there, you know, or some people to talk to. And sure enough, you know, there were two guys there that had come there early to make coffee, and they were unloading the pots and stuff. And I owe those two guys a lot, because if they hadn't been there, I don't know that I would have ever come back. I might have just peeked in and seen that no one was there and thought, well, you know, I'm going to go try something else. Because by that time, I was going to bars still after I got off work, because I didn't know what to do with my free time. You quit drinking, you got a big block of time in there to fill. So I just thought I could go back to the bars and drink Perrier and watch everybody else sit there and get smooth and slick. And that doesn't work either, if you're thinking about that. You just get phone numbers in AA and start calling people, because they'll find something for you to do with your time. And these two guys did. I stood there talking to them for a while, and they said, are you an alcoholic, Charles? And I said, I don't think so. I really don't. And this guy, Doc, who'd been sober, I guess, about 5 or 6 years at the time, said, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. He said, do you think many social drinkers come to AA meetings on a real nice day like this 3.5 hours early because they're afraid of drinking at home? And I really resent logic like that. But he was right, and he said, look, just why don't you go over and start setting up chairs, and we'll get ready for the meeting, and then we'll go get a donut or something across the street. So we did that. We went and got a donut or coffee or something. I forget what it was, and brought something back for the treasurer, who was in an eating frenzy. And I started going to that meeting, and after I set up those chairs, I really started feeling like I had a stake in that meeting because I'd done something. You know, I finally done something there, and I didn't even know it. I just did it because these guys told me to, and I thought that they would approve of me if I did it. So I sat up the chairs, and I realized something right away in AA, and that is the minute you invest yourself in being of service to anybody, it becomes your meeting, becomes your place, that becomes your job. AA is the only place you can go where you can find two guys in $600 suits struggling over a mop. You know, my commitment. No, you son of a bitch, mine. And they're fighting to keep those commitments because that's what keeps alcoholics like us sober, you know? Showing up. And it's not just enough to show up. You got to show up. Even no matter how bad you feel, I found this to be true. If I feel really bad, I have to go and just turn the thought around to be of service to somebody else rather than trying to soak off the meeting. You know, when I'm feeling really good, I can go to a meeting and I can enjoy the atmosphere of the meeting and sit back and enjoy. But when I'm feeling bad, I've got to find somebody there who looks worse than I do. And some nights that's pretty hard. You really got to go beating the brambles to find somebody like that. And I always do. There's always some pathetic person there who looks completely lost. They've got that deer caught in headlights look that we're familiar with. You just find that person, you know. And I'm still, I got a sponsor. My sponsor's been with me for the whole time I've been sober since I got him. And that man has sat with me at times when I really believed I couldn't stay sober. And there have been many times in my sobriety where I really was afraid I could not stay sober. It was just like a tissue-thin distance between me and a drink. And I thought I was so weak at that time. And that guy was always there, you know. It didn't matter where he was or what he was doing. I always managed to get in contact with him because that's one thing I found out being sober. The people who stay sober are the people who, when they're just about to feel like they're going to go out, they call and get a second opinion, you know. Just to call and tell them, I just wanted to call you and thank you for everything you've done. I'm going to go out and drink myself to death, but thanks a bunch. Something tells me that when a person calls you to do that, that they are really willing to stay sober if you just let them talk. And my sponsor's always been there and has kept me going through the steps and doing the things we have to do here. And the thing that he's taught me the most of anything, because he's as outraged about the world as I am. Sometimes I hesitate to tell him when I feel like I've been slighted by people because he gets into a bigger lather than I do. And I wind up trying to calm him down and tell him, you know, with these steps and a loving God, Bill, you can find some inner serenity like I have. And I don't tell him that much because he's ripped my arm off. And the thing that I've learned about the most in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I have to start to curb my own behavior and curb those things and try to change the way I act by using the steps. My life is completely different than it was when I first came here. I came here working on the receiving dock of that bookstore. At 2 years sober, one of the deans at that college asked me if I would teach a class. I didn't want to teach it, but my sponsor had some other advice, and I thought it would be better if I took as a year and just got into teaching, started to learn how to do it. My friend Mark, who drove out here with me tonight, Mark and I were new together, and he had a career going, and he had to drop his career and go work in a shoe store for a year, and his sponsor told him, just go to meetings. So he dropped a huge career, went to work in a shoe store, and I'm working in this bookstore, and we're on the phone like 6 times a day. What the son of a bitch tell you to do? I don't know. I have to stay here overtime. I have to take inventory. Yeah, me too. I got to do this. I got to take the teaching job. And we're laughing about it over the phone. And we stay sober by making friends in Alcoholics Anonymous and keeping that phone contact with them because we stayed, you know. And hundreds of people who've been here since I have, who I've gotten to know and care about, have gone. And I don't know where they are. I hope some of them are sober, but I know a lot of them aren't. I know that most of the people who leave Alcoholics Anonymous don't stay sober. You know, it's just a phenomenon of the disease. It has nothing to do with the individual. And the thing I have to remember is that I have to dig my heels in here, especially when I feel bad. And I began teaching high school at about 5 years sober, which is a journey. It's like a luge ride into the crapper sometimes. Especially this time of year when you're fighting spring fever, hormones, and summer vacation on the horizon. And, you know, here I am. I'm a Catholic school teacher. The guy who was stealing porno magazines out of the street machines, crawling out of massage parlors in San Francisco, stone drunk, whose brain was melting in the shimmy shack in Garden Grove one time. And I'm teaching values to high school kids. Now, there's something to sleep with tonight. I also got my writing career started through a series of lucky events. I like to think of them as luck and as also being willing to take chances when I thought I might fail, because Bill taught me something very important when I took that teaching job. He said, I didn't want to take it because I was terrified. I never wanted to be a high school teacher. I was a lousy high school student. And he said, well, just do it for AA. You know, and that sounds like get one for the Gipper, you know. And I said, what the hell has taking that job got to do with AA? And he said, well, you got to take it because you might fail. And I said, thank you. You know, this is the night before I'm going to walk into a classroom full of hostile teenagers. And he says, you might fail. And you'll go in there and you'll fail. And you'll know you failed. And you'll know you shouldn't be a teacher. And you'll go back and you'll stay sober and you'll move on. And other people can look at you as someone who took a chance and kept doing it, you know. Or you cannot take it, stay here, and be Price and pencils when you're 70 years old and wonder if you could have done it. You know, choice is yours. Thank you very much. You know, big choice then. And so I did it, and I'm my life today, despite all the things that are going on, is very rich. I have a good job. I'm in love. I feel loved. I'm happy. I'm comfortable most of the time. You know, knowing that I have a whole group of people that are my people. This is my life, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous is my family and my life. I don't turn down AA commitments because no, AA has never turned anything down that I've asked of it, ever. The program hasn't let me down. My higher power hasn't let me down. The steps have never let me down. They only fortify my reason for being here. I have to change and I have to live in that world out there, and this teaches me how to take what we learn here and move out there and move comfortably out there and carry the message that we have, even in every area of my life where people aren't alcoholics who may need something like this, who may need at least forgiveness, at least kindness, at least compassion. I learned to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I feel blessed, you know, and I feel like the people who are here, we're here for a reason. We're here because that higher power, if you're new, you don't have to worry about a higher power now. Just look at the people around you tonight, and these people, all of us, would be drunk were it not for a power that's greater than each of us individually. The fact that we're here and we're leaning on each other means that none of us has to fall down. Even when we feel the weakest, we're left standing. You know, we may start to buckle, but there are people here to hold us up. And I thank you for holding me up tonight. Thanks.
I'm Dave, alcoholic.
Hi, Dave.
I guess I'll share a little bit what it was like. And, you know? Yes, it's getting a little hot up here. I don't know. I came from a dysfunctional home, and you know, I had a bad time. And anyways, I ended up here, and I was for a long time. I'd just been seeking happiness, and only place I saw it was here. And I've been skidding by, and I've got a sponsor now and working my steps and trying to get that happiness. Anyways, thanks a lot.
We have a 7-year birthday for Todd L.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Todd. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Keith D., the guys I sponsor, God AA, my lovely wife, Michelle. Sue, Johnny, and all of you. Thank you.